Bill Moyers asked me to keep this short and simple. As I checked a few facts, I asked Bill whether he was the son of a Baptist minister. He said no. Actually, he was the son of a Baptist deacon. And it sounds like his mother, who ran the sword drill in Marshall, may have been the stronger influence. For those of you who, like me, spent a wasted youth, the sword drill was held on Sunday nights at the Baptist Training Union in Marshall and in scores of other churches and halls across the South. As Bill reminded me, you lined up, you held your Bible in your left hand, and then you held your right hand across it like this, and you waited for the command, go, so you could begin the frenetic search for a certain passage. As Bill described it to me, and I quote, the first to find the text won. It was made harder, of course, if you had hidden your clipped out Reader's Digest jokes in the Bible, which went unopened from Sunday to Sunday, thus making it a safe hiding place for the stored relief from boring sermons. Sometimes you would slip into the Bible a few of those salacious little trading cards making the rounds of the black market, showing, among other things, David lusting for Bathsheba. I relate this because it reveals Bill's care for repertorial accuracy, a deacon, not a minister, mind you, his rich background in Texas, his sense of humor, and his reverence for the teachers in his life. He is really a teacher as much as a journalist. All of these things are things that have resonated in his work over the years. Bill Moyers was born in Oklahoma in 1934 and was raised in East Texas. He began as a cub on the Marshall News Messenger at the age of 16. He was deputy director of the Peace Corps under Kennedy and a special assistant to Johnson. He is an author, was publisher of Newsday, and has been a broadcast journalist for many years. In December, Bill ended his three-year stint as host of the PBS Weekly News Magazine Now. He and his wife, Judith Davidson Moyers, founded Public Affairs Television, Inc. in 1986. He is now president of the Florence and John Schumann Foundation. Bill is a member of the People's Club, not a governmental or media elite. He is a ruminative voice who can engage the abstractions of life pleasantly and a straight-to-the-facts reporter. A tolerant man who seems to enjoy a conversation with Grover Norquist or Cal Thomas as much as one with Betty Sue Flowers, Joseph Campbell, or Judy Collins. He connects the dots, a reporter who lets others do the first day and second day stories. Bill goes after the second month story. Now, early in the eighth decade of his life, he is learning every day. May we all continue to learn together. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Bill Moyers.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for that welcome, and thank you, Rich, for that very generous introduction. And thank you for inviting me here today and for counting me as a colleague. Sitting with Mark and being reminded of what he and the Times-Picayune did before Katrina in exploring the fragility and vulnerability of the levees and the wetlands there, reports on which we based two very strong reports on my weekly series. Sitting by Mark and seeing so many of you here, I'm reminded of the dilemma, even the tragic dilemma of American journalism today. There is still world-class journalism being done, some of it by people in this room, and the tragedy is that it is so often ignored by the powers that be. But I am delighted to be with you. I just wish Kevin Carmody was here with us, and I guess in a way he is. I don't fit neatly into the job description of an environmental journalist, although I have kept returning to the beat ever since my first documentary on the subject some 32 years ago. It was a story about how the new Republican governor of Oregon, Tom McCall, had set out to prove that the economy and the environment could share the center lane on the highway to the future. Those were optimistic years for the environmental movement. Rachel Carson had rattled a cage with Silent Spring, and on that first Earth Day in 1970, some 20 million Americans rose from the grassroots to speak for a healthy and safe environment. Even Richard Nixon couldn't say no to so powerful a subpoena by public opinion. I shared that optimism, and I believed that journalism would help to fulfill it. I thought that when people saw a good example, they would imitate it, that if Americans knew the facts and the possibilities, they would act on them. After all, every day that I walked across my alma mater here, the University of Texas, I could look up at the tower and see the words that are emboldened there, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." My first job in broadcasting was here in Austin. I came as a junior, got a job on LBJ and Lady Bird Station, KDBC. It was the first station in Texas to buy a station wagon, paint it red, and call it, appropriately, Red Rover. Carlton Heston, on the backlots of Hollywood, speeding in a chariot for the glories of Rome, couldn't have had more fun than I did here in Austin, wheeling around town in style, covering crime scenes, accidents, and the state legislature, which was the biggest crime scene of all. But I did believe that you shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free. I thought we were really on the way back in the 70s toward the third American Revolution. The first had won our independence as a nation. The second had finally opened the promise of civil rights to all Americans. And now the third American Revolution was to be a green revolution, leading to a healthy, safe, and sustainable future. Sometimes, in a moment of reverie, I imagine that it happened. I imagine that we had brought forth a new paradigm for nurturing and protecting our global life support system, that we had faced up to the greatest ecological challenge in human history and had conquered it with clean, renewable energy, efficient transportation and agriculture, and the non-toxic production of our forests, oceans, grasslands, and wetlands. I imagined us leading the world on a new path of sustainability. Then, of course, the reverie ends. I wake up in the real world, and I realize that rather than leading the world in finding solutions to the global environmental crisis, the United States has become a recalcitrant backslider and naysayer. Our government and our corporate elites have turned against America's environmental visionaries, from Teddy Roosevelt to John Muir, from Rachel Carson to David Brower, from Gaylord Nelson to Lawrence Rockefeller, and they've set out to eviscerate just about every significant gain of the past generation. And while they are doing that, they have managed to blame the environmental movement itself for the failure of the Green Revolution. If environmentalism isn't dead, as you heard in your discussion with Judy Muller, they say it should be, and they will gladly lead the cortege to the grave. Now, I know, you know, all of us know, the environmental community has stumbled on many fronts. We've heard and reported the charges. The rhetoric is alarmist and the ideology polarizing. Command and control regulation produces bureaucratic bungles, slows economic growth, and delays technological advances that save lives. What began as a grassroots movement has now become, in some respects, an entrenched green bureaucracy precariously hanging on in occupied Washington while passionate citizens across the country are denied financial resources. I know, you know, there's some truth to this. But before we consider the case closed, I'd like to urge us to take a hard look at the backlash. I didn't anticipate the backlash. If the Green Revolution is a bloody pulp today, as someone recently wrote, it is not because the environmental movement mugged itself. The corporate, political, and religious right ganged up on it in the back alleys of power. Big companies funded a relentless assault on green values and policies. Political ideologues launched a campaign to strip from government all its functions except those that reward their rich benefactors. And homegrown ayatollahs are more set on savaging gay people than saving a green earth. We fail to anticipate how reckless and ruthless these reactionaries would be. I once did a documentary on what they had done to Rachel Carson for Silent Spring. What they did there has been honed to a sharp edge, aimed directly at the jugular of anyone, including journalists, who challenged them. I felt the knife's edge myself some years ago when I took up the subject of pesticides and food for a Frontline documentary on PBS. My producer, Marty Kuhn, learned that the industry was plotting behind the scenes to dilute the findings of a National Academy of Science study on the effect of pesticide residues in children. When the companies found out we were onto the story, they came after us. Before the documentary aired, television reviewers and the editorial pages of newspapers were flooded with disinformation. A whispering campaign took hold. One columnist for the Washington Post took a dig at the broadcast without ever having seen it, and later confessed to me that he'd gotten a bum tip about the content from a top lobbyist for the chemical industry and printed it without calling me for a response. Some public television managers were so unnerved by the propaganda blitz against a yet-to-be-aired documentary that they actually wrote letters to PBS prepared by the chemical industry. But here's what most perplexed us. 8 days before the broadcast, the American Cancer Society, an organization that in no way figured in our documentary, sent to its 3,000 local chapters around the country a critique of the unfinished documentary, claiming wrongly that it exaggerated the dangers of pesticides in food. We were puzzled. Why was the American Cancer Society taking the unusual step of criticizing a documentary it had not yet seen, that had not yet aired, and that did not claim what the society was alleging? An enterprising reporter named Sheila Kaplan, working for the Legal Times newspaper, looked into the matter. And she found that the Porter Novelli public relations firm, which had several clients among the chemical companies, also did pro bono work for the American Cancer Society. And the firm was able to cash in some of that goodwill from the, quote, charitable work they did to persuade the communication staff at the society to distribute erroneous talking points about the documentary before it aired. Talking points supplied by, but not attributed to, Porter Novelli. Legal Times headlined the story, "Porter Novelli Plays All Sides," a familiar Washington game. This was just round one. The producer, Sherry Jones, and I spent more than a year working on another PBS documentary called Trade Secrets. It was a two-hour investigative report based on records from the industry's own archives. Those internal documents revealed without any doubt that for over 40 years, the big chemical companies had deliberately withheld from workers and consumers damaging information about toxic chemicals in their products. They confirmed not only that a shameless, amoral industry had deceived the American people, they confirmed that we were living under a regulatory system designed by the chemical industry itself, one that put profits ahead of safety. Once again, the industry went on the assault. We found ourselves the targets this time of another public relations firm, one noted for using private detectives and former CIA, FBI, and drug enforcement officers to conduct investigations for big business. One of its founders had once acknowledged publicly that corporations, quote, sometimes resort to unconventional resources, including using deceit. They tried to smear the documentary. They couldn't smear the documentary. They tried to smear me. They brought incredible pressure to bear on PBS not to run the documentary at all. These tactics didn't work. The documentary ran, created a big impact across the country, and received from our peers an Emmy for investigative journalism. But this crowd never gives up. As all of you know so well, President Bush has turned the agencies charged with environmental protection over to the forces that don't believe in it. It's like sending an atheist to the Vatican. To run the Interior Department, he chose a longtime defender of polluters who has opposed laws to safeguard wildlife, habitat, and public lands. To run the Forest Service, he chose a timber industry lobbyist. To oversee our public lands, he named a mining industry lobbyist who believes public lands are unconstitutional. To run the Superfund, he chose a woman who made her living advising corporate polluters how to subvert Superfund. And in the White House Office of Environmental Policy, The president placed a lobbyist from the American Petroleum Institute, whose mission was to make sure the government's scientific reports on global warming didn't contradict the party line and the interest of oil companies. Now, my colleagues and I reported these stories week after week on Now with Bill Moyers, to the consternation of the president's minions at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The chairman, Kenneth Tomlinson, turned the administration's discomfort at embarrassing disclosures into a crusade to discredit us. You may have noticed that Tomlinson's chairmanship at the CPB expired this week, but the coup at public broadcasting has taken place. He remains on the board under a new chair who is a former real estate director and a Republican fundraiser who has said that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting should have the authority to penalize public broadcasting journalists if they step out of line. Sitting beside her and Tomlinson on the board is another Bush appointee, a Republican activist who was a charter member and chair of Newt Gingrich's Political Action Committee, GOPAC, back in the 90s when it was notorious for scurrilous and partisan attacks on journalists and others. As president and CEO, the CPB board has chosen the former co-chair of the Republican National Committee, whose husband became PR director of the Chemical Manufacturers Association after he had helped the pesticide industry smear Rachel Carson for her classic work on the environment, Silent Spring. Mark my word, this crowd intends that there be no challenging journalism to come from public broadcasting, no investigative reporting on the environment, no reporting at all on the conflicts of interest between government and big business. No, if the environmental movement is pronounced dead, it will not be from self-inflicted wounds. We can't blame slavery on the slaves, the Trail of Tears on the Cherokees, or the Srebrenica massacre on the bodies in the grave. The lethal threat to the environment comes from the predatory power of money and a homicidal right-wing ideology. Theodore Roosevelt warned a century ago against the subversive power of money. He said the central fact in his time was that big business had become so dominant it would chew up democracy and spit it out. The power of corporations, he said, had to be balanced with the interest of the general public. That warning was echoed by his cousin Franklin Roosevelt, who said a government by organized money is as much to be feared as a government by organized mob. Both Roosevelts rose to their challenge in their day. But 100 years later, mighty corporations are once again the overlord of politics and government. Follow the money, and you're inside the inner sanctum of the Business Roundtable, the National Association of Manufacturers, and the American Petroleum Institute. Here is the super board of directors for Bush Incorporated. They own the administration, lock, stock, and barrel, and their collusion is leading to calamitous consequences. Once the leader in cutting-edge environmental policies and technologies and awareness, America is now eclipsed. As the scientific evidence grows, pointing to a crisis in the global climate, our country has become an impediment to action, not a leader. Earlier this year, the White House even conducted an extraordinary secret campaign to scupper the British government's attempt to tackle global warming, and then to undermine the UN's effort to stabilize greenhouse gas emissions. I'll say something that wouldn't pass your typical copy desk, but I believe George W. Bush is going down as the Herbert Hoover of the environment. His failure to lead on global warming means that even if we were dramatically to decrease greenhouse gases overnight, we have already condemned ourselves and generations to come to a warmer planet. You no doubt saw those reports a few days ago that the Arctic has suffered another record loss of sea ice. I'm sure you discussed them here this week. Satellites monitoring the region found that ice reached its lowest monthly point on record this summer, The fourth year in a row, it's fallen below the monthly downward trend. The anticipated effects are well known to all of us. As the Arctic region absorbs more heat from the sun, causing the ice to melt still further, the relentless cycle of melting and heating will shrink the massive land glaciers of Greenland and dramatically raise sea levels. Scientists were quoted saying that with this new acceleration of melt, the northern hemisphere may have crossed a critical threshold, quote, beyond which the climate cannot recover. Nevertheless, despite all that those of us in this room do, last year a Gallup poll found that nearly half of Americans worry only a little or not at all about global warming or the greenhouse effect. In July of this year, ABC News reported that 66% of the people in a new survey said they didn't think global warming will affect their lives. I hope you've seen the film March of the Pilgrims, have you? Pilgrims, I'm sorry. That's the old Baptist in me. March of the Pilgrims. I'm afraid they lost out to the Puritans and they've lost out to the fundamentalists. But anyway, if you've seen March of the Penguins, you know it's a delight to the eye and a tug to the heart. The camera follows the flocks as they trek back and forth over the ice to their breeding ground. You see them huddle together to protect their eggs in temperatures that average 70 degrees below Fahrenheit. I mean, it's so powerful and beautiful, a film can only increase one's awe of our small neighbors to the far north. But in the New York Times recently, Jonathan Millen reported that conservatives are invoking March of the Penguins as an inspiration for their various causes. Some praise the penguins for their monogamy. I'm so glad Rich said that I document everything I say. I'm not making this up. Opponents of abortion say it verifies the beauty of life and the rightness of protecting it. A Christian magazine claims it makes a strong case for intelligent design. On the website, look it up, lionsofgod.com, you can actually find instructions to take a notebook, flashlight, and pen to the movie, quote, to write down what God speaks to you as you watch the film. Fair enough. It would not be the first time that human beings felt connected to a transcendental power through nature. But what you will not find in March of the Penguins is any reference to global warming. I mean, why is it relevant? Because to reproduce, the penguins must go to the thickest part of the ice where they can safely stand without fear that it will break beneath their weight. Global warming obviously weakens the ice, and if it becomes too thin, the penguins will lose the support necessary for reproduction. Yet this film is silent on this threat to these little creatures the conservatives are adopting as their mascots in the culture wars. The film's director explained that he wanted to reach as many people as possible, and since, quote, much of the public opinion appears insensitive to the dangers of global warming, he didn't want to go there. Again, fair enough. I can't fault him for the aspiration to tell the story for its own sake in the most simple and profound way. I can't fault him for wanting to avoid disturbing the comfort of viewers. I often wish that I were a filmmaker instead of a journalist and didn't have to give people a headache by reporting the news they'd rather not hear. But you know, what we don't know can kill us. Our oldest son is an alcoholic and drug addict. I'm not spilling any family secrets here. My wife Judith and I produced a series for PBS on our family's experience and called it Close to Home because we wanted to remind people that addiction hijacks the brain irrespective of race, creed, color, or street address. He's doing well, thank you. He's been in recovery for 10 years now and has become one of the country's leading public advocates for treatment. In fact, he'll be speaking here in Austin 10 days from now. But we almost lost him more than once because he was in denial, and so were we. He would not admit for 10 years prior to his crash that what was happening, and he was able to hide it from us. He was, after all, a rising star in journalism, Newsday, the Dallas Times Herald, and finally at CNN. He was married, a homeowner, and a God-fearing churchgoer. Naturally, we believed the best about him. A drug addict slowly poisoning himself to death? Not our son. The day before he crashed, I was so concerned about his behavior that I asked him to go to lunch. Are you in trouble? I asked him. Are you using? He looked me squarely in the eye and said, of course not, Dad. I just got a little trouble at home. Whew, I said, I'm so glad of that, and I switched the subject to politics. The next day, he was gone. We searched for days before his mother and a friend tracked him down and coaxed him over the hours from a crack house to a hospital. They say denial is not a river in Egypt. But I will tell you, it is the governing philosophy in Washington, D.C. Our president is in deep denial. And his contempt for science, for evidence that mounts every day, is mind-boggling, costly, and dangerous. Here is a man who was quick to launch a preventive war against Iraq on faulty intelligence and premature judgment, but who refuses to take a preventive action against a truly global menace about which the scientific evidence is overwhelming. Sadly, those people in his core constituency who could most effectively call on the president to lead are largely silent. I mean the Christian conservatives who gave President Bush 15 million votes in 2000 and maybe another 20 million in 2004. Without their support, the corrupt transnational corporations who now control Washington would fail to have the votes needed to attack the environment as they are doing. Now, when it comes to the environment, some of these Christian conservatives are irredeemable, no pun intended. They are merely clay in the hands of their pastors, preachers, and prophets who have signed on with the Republican Party to turn their faith into a political religion, a weapon in political combat. But millions of these people, and I know them well, I grew up with them. I am myself an evangelical Christian. Millions of these people believe they are here on earth to serve a higher moral purpose, not a partisan agenda. It is they who overwhelmingly respond to natural disasters like last year's tsunami or the AIDS crisis in Africa by opening their hearts and their wallets quite wide. Unfortunately, although many of them believe Christians have a moral obligation to protect God's creation, most remain uninformed about the true scope of the environmental crisis and the role of the Republican Party in it. I recommend to you a remarkable, fascinating, and very important piece in the Columbia Journalism Review last fall about how the Christians in this country have built up their own separate universe of media, silos of print and radio and television, to which they go for the only news they get about the world that we all share in common. So as a result of this, they often vote their consciences on social issues rather than on environmental issues. Listen to this anguished moral missive from called to my attention by my friend and colleague Glenn Scherer, whom I think is here today. Glenn, where are you? I guess he didn't make it. Oh, there he is. There he is. Hi, Glenn. Glenn sent me an article from a magazine called Earth Magazine by a Christian, conservative Christian named Joel Gillespie. Quote, I'll admit that when I pushed the button for President Bush, I did so with sadness, given his dismal environmental record. But many of us who love the natural world feel we face an almost impossible either-or predicament. Voting for pro-environment candidates usually means voting for a package of other policies that we will never swallow. We're forced to choose between unborn babies or endangered species, traditional marriage or habitat protection, cleaning up the smut that comes across the airwaves or the smut that fouls our air. And the fact that we're forced to make such choices has harmed the natural environment and the special places we love and cherish. Now, there are many evangelical Christians who face Gillespie's dilemma. I think all of us, environmental journalists, without sacrificing or compromising the ethics and tools of our craft, can help to get them to look more closely at their moral choices, to consider whether it's possible to be pro-life while also being anti-environment. I think it is. If you believe uncompromisingly in the right of every baby conceived to be born safely into this world, you cannot at the same time abandon the future of that child, allowing its health and safety to be compromised by a president who gives big corporations license to poison our bodies and destroy our climate. In that grandstanding that he did during the Schiavo Right to Die case last spring, President Bush said something important. It is wise to always err on the side of life. And he went on to plead for a culture of life that became a mantra in the election campaign of last fall. But I would inform Christian conservatives that Mr. Bush, by ignoring the wise counsel of thousands of environmental scientists, is not erring on the side of life. He's playing dice with our children's lives, dice that we may have likely loaded against our own species and perhaps against life all over this earth. There is, as Glenn reminds me, a market here for the freelance journalists who are always hungry for new readers. The Christian audience, Christian conservative audience, is roughly some 50 million people strong. But to reach them, you have to cater to them. You have to do environmental stories that touch their hearts, stories done with care and respect for their belief systems. Reverend Jim Ball of the Evangelical Environmental Network, for example, tells us that, quote, creation caring is starting to resonate not just with evangelical progressives, but with conservatives who are at the center of the evangelical spectrum. Last year, in a very important document, the National Association of Evangelicals declared that our Bible implies the principle of sustainability. Our uses of the earth must be designed to conserve and renew the earth rather than to deplete or destroy it. And then they went on, it looked to me as if they had cribbed or even plagiarized right out of the Sierra Club, a statement that said that urged government to encourage fuel efficiency, reduce pollution, encourage sustainable use of natural resources, and provide for the proper care of wildlife and their natural habitats. All but a few evangelical leaders have also pushed for a global change climate program, standing up to demagogues like James Dobson, Pat Robertson, and Jerry Falwell, who are suckers for the corporate-funded right wing of the Republican Party. But we can't expect to engage this vast Christian audience with our standard style of reporting. Environmental journalism has always spoken in the language of environmental science. But fundamentalists and Pentecostals, as you know, typically speak and think in a different language. Theirs is a poetic and metaphorical language, a speech that is anchored in the literal truth of the Bible as they read it. Their moral actions are not guided by the newest IPCC report, but by the books of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And when I was working on this speech, I was reminded of the series I did many years ago, Joseph Campbell and the Power of Myth. In the last part of that series, Joseph Campbell said to me, you know, Moyers, if you want to change the world, you have to change the metaphors. You have to change the metaphors that frame how people see and respond to the reality around them. You have to change from the prose of life to the poetry of life. That's one reason I've done so many series on poetry in my long career in broadcasting. Here's an important statistic to ponder before you start writing your first piece for the Christian right market. 45% of Americans hold a creational view of the world, discounting Darwin's theory of evolution. I don't think it's a coincidence that in a nation where nearly half our people believe in creationism, much of the population also doubts the certainty of climate science. Contrast that to other industrial nations, Britain, for example, where 81% of the people accept the science of global warming. Here's the problem. Creationists accept the literal story of Genesis. One of my favorite series that I've also done was a 10-part series called Genesis a number of years ago. We called together people from all faiths, no faiths, artists, theologians, philosophers, politicians, and we spent 10 weeks just discussing from those different perspectives the first 10 stories in the book of Genesis. You come away understanding that anyone who accepts the literal meaning of Genesis is going to deny and distrust a lot of science, not only evolution, but paleontology, archaeology, geology, genetics, even biology and botany. To those Christians who believe that our history began with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and there are a lot of them, and that it will soon end on the plains of Armageddon. Environmental science, with its urgent warnings of planetary peril, must look at best irrelevant. And at worst, the environmental woes we report may be historically viewed as the inevitable playing out of the end time as presented in the book of Revelation. And for Christian Dominus, who believe the Lord will provide for all human needs and never leave us short of oil or other resources, no matter how much we populate the earth, our reporting may be viewed as a direct attack on biblical teachers that tell us to be fruitful and multiply. I suggest to you that among many Christian conservatives, our environmental reporting, if they see it at all, could seem arrogant in its assumptions, mechanistic, cold, and godless in its worldview. A tough indictment, I recognize, but one that must be faced if we are to be effective reporters. It's no sense speaking Spanish to an audience that speaks French. You have to learn to speak in the language by which people live their lives, imagine their futures. So how would I tell the story of global warming to these people? Well, instead of bombarding readers and viewers with scientific statistics, as I have done over the years, I'd learn a new spiritual language, the language of parable. The Bush administration has achieved great success getting points across using the symbolic language of the Bible, and I think we journalists can do so too. Let's say, for example, that I wanted to write a piece about the million species that might be put on the road to extinction by global warming. Reporting that story to a scientific audience, obviously, I would talk science. I'd tell how a species decimated by climate change could reach a point of no return when its gene pool becomes too depleted to maintain its evolutionary adaptability. That genetic impoverishment can eventually lead to extinction. But how would I tell that story to fundamentalist Christians who doubt evolution? How would I ever get them to hear me? Well, I might interview a minister who could couch the work of today's climate and biodiversity scientists in biblical metaphor, the story, for example, of Noah and the flood. The parallels of this parable are really wonderful to behold. Both the scientist and Noah, as you know, possess knowledge of a potentially impending global catastrophe. They try to spread the word, to warn the world, but they're laughed at, ridiculed. You can almost hear some Philistine editorial writer telling old Noel he's nothing but a gloom and doom, Moyers kind of environmentalist, spreading his tale of abrupt climate change, of a great flood that will drown the world, of the impending extinction of humanity and animals if no one acts. And no one does act. So Noah continues hearing the word of God. Noah, you're to bring into the ark two of all living creatures, male and female, to keep them alive with you. Noah does as God commands. He agrees to save not only his own family, but to take on the daunting task of rescuing all the biodiversity of the earth. He builds the ark. He's ridiculed as mad, but he gathers each two of every species. The climate does change. The deluge comes as predicted. Everyone not safely aboard drowns. But Noah and the complete complement of earth's animals live on. You've seen the pictures of them disembarking the ark beneath a rainbow, two by two, the giraffes and the hippos, the horses and the zebras. Noah then can be seen, I think, as the first great preservationist, preventing the first great extinction. He did exactly what wildlife biologists and climatologists are trying to do today, to act on their moral convictions to conserve diversity, to protect God's creation in the face of a flood of consumerism and indifference by a materialistic world ruled by princes in denial. Now, I know some of you are probably feeling uncomfortable with this parable. Let me assure you that if you go right on to the next chapter, the day after Noah is off the ark, he does what any good journalist does. He gets drunk. So he's got a little bit of the preservationist in him, but he's got a little bit of the journalist in him, right? But you know, when we laugh, we know exactly now how a fundamentalist Christian who believes devoutly in creationism feels when we journalists write about the genetics born of Darwin. But if we can't adapt, if we can't tell the story of melting ice sheets without being aware of others' beliefs, no matter how much they vary from our own, if we can't empathize with each person's need to understand a human problem in the language of his or own worldview, then we will likely fail to reach many Christian conservatives, people who have a strong sense of morality and justice as we do, and we will have done little to head off the sixth great extinction. Now, let me quickly reassure you in closing. I'm not asking that we give up investigative journalism. To the contrary, I want to make Kenneth Thompson squirm in his seat. But even as I search in my own work for new language to reach a new audience, I find myself thinking back to the years leading up to the 19th century, to the first Gilded Age. It was a time like ours. Gross materialism and blatant political corruption were on a rampage. Big business had bought the government right out from under the people and formed an unholy alliance that gorged on greed at the expense of everyone else. Outraged at the abuse of power, the publisher of McClure's magazine cried out to his fellow journalists, capitalists, politicians, all breaking the law or letting it be broken. There is no one left to uphold it, none but all of us. My God, what a response. The Gilded Age became the Golden Age of muckraking journalism. Lincoln Steffens plunged into the shame of the cities, a boiling cauldron of putrid conspiracy, of bribes, of dead dogs voting, of children voting twice, of non-existent persons, including founders of the Declaration of Independence, voting in Philadelphia. And his reporting sparked an era of electoral reform. Nellie Bly infiltrated a mental hospital, pretending to be insane, and wrote of the horrors within, arousing the public conscience. John Spargo disappeared into the black bowels of coal mines and came back to crusade against child labor, for he had found their little children, quote, alone in a dark mine, passage hour after hour with no human soul near, to see no living creature except a rat or two seeking to share one's meals, to stand in water or mud that covers the ankles, chilled to the marrow, to work for 14 hours for 60 cents, to reach the surface when all is wrapped in the mantle of night, and to fall to the earth exhausted and have to be carried away to the nearest shack. Upton Sinclair waded through hell and with tears and anguish described what he found on that arm of the Chicago River known as Bubbly Creek on the southern boundary of the stockyards, where all the drainage of the square mile of packing houses empties so that it is nearly a great sewer. And the filth stays there forever and a day. The grease and chemicals that are poured into it undergo all sorts of strange transformations. Sounds like the Gulf Coast. Bubbles of carbonic acid gas rising to the surface and bursting, making rings 2 or 3 feet wide. Here and there, the grease and filth have caked solid, and the creek looks like a bed of lava. The packers used to leave the creek that way until every now and then the surface would catch on fire and burn furiously, and the fire department would have to come and put it out. The Gilded Age has returned with a vengeance, and Washington is once again a spectacle of corruption. The promise of America subverted to crony capitalism, sleazy lobbying, and an arrogance of power matched only by an arrogance of the present that acts as if there is no tomorrow. But there is a tomorrow. I see the future every time I work at my desk, because beside my computer are the photographs of Henry 13, Thomas 11, Nancy 9, Jassy 4, and Sarah Jane 2 years. My grandchildren, they have no vote, and they have no voice. They have no party, and they have no press. They have no lobbyists in Washington. They have only you and me, our pens and keyboards and microphones, to seek and speak and publish what we find of the truth as we know it, to tell how power works, how the world wags, and who's wagging it. A lot is riding on what you do. You may be the last group of journalists who take the public interest as a calling to try to inform the rest of us about the most complex of issues. I don't believe we will survive without you. Without your work, we'll never understand what's at stake. Let me tell you very quickly what's at stake. Last year, my final year now with Bill Moyers, we produced a documentary called Endangered Species about a neighborhood in Washington, D.C. known as Anacostia, just a few blocks from Capitol Hill. It's one of the most violent and dangerous neighborhoods in the city, one of those places that give the seat of our government the horrendous distinction of the highest murder rate of any major city in America. It's horrendous in other ways, too. The Anacostia River that gives the neighborhood its name is one of the most polluted in America. More than 1 billion gallons of raw sewage end up there every year. We went there to report on the Earth Conservation Corps, a project started by one Robert Nixon, to recruit neighborhood kids to help clean up the river and community. For their efforts, they earn minimum wage, get health insurance, and are offered a $5,000 scholarship if they go back to school. The area where they work is practically a war zone. Since the project began, an average of one Corps member has been murdered every year. One was beaten to death, one was raped and killed, another died when he was caught in the middle of a shooting while riding his bike, three were shot to death execution style. One of the most charismatic of the kids who joined the Corps was named Diamond Teague. He worked so hard, the others jokingly called him the choir boy. His work became his passion. He loved it. It gave purpose and meaning to his life, cleaning up his neighborhood and a river. But one morning, while Diamond Teague was sitting on his front porch, someone walked up and shot him to death. It's that kind of place. Not far from where the swells of Congress are hosted and toasted by lobbyists for America's most powerful and privileged interests. After his death, Diamond Teague got the only press of his short life. 43 words in the Washington Post. Quote, a teenager was found fatally shot about 2:05 Thursday in the 2200 block of Prout Place Southwest, police said. Diamond D. Teague, 19, who lived on the block, was pronounced dead. That's all. That was Diamond Teague's obit. Not a word about his work for the Conservation Corps. Not a word. It was left to his friends to tell the world about Diamond Teague. One of them explained to us that they wanted to get people to know that just because a black man gets killed in the southeast corner of the nation's capital, he's not just a drug dealer or a gangbanger, and not just discount him as nobody when he deserves for people to know him and to know his life. They made a video. We used some of it in our documentary. They turned out for his funeral in uniform. They wept and prayed for their fallen friend, and they then went back to work on a dusty patch of land squeezed between two factories that they envisioned as a park. We see the bigger future, one of Diamond's friends told us. All great things have to start in roughness. We're just the beginning of something that's going to be beautiful. They said they would call it the Diamond Teague Memorial Park in honor of their friend. The bigger picture is what's at stake. Who is left to tell America what's happening? There's no one left. None but all of us. Thank you.
Bill, that was I think we'll all agree, it was an extraordinary speech. It was certainly one of the best I've heard in years. Now, before we all get together at 3 o'clock over in Darrell Royal Stadium for a sword drill to search for appropriate similes and metaphors for the Endangered Species Act, Mr. Moyers has agreed to take some questions. I understand. I don't see it. Yeah, here it is. There's a microphone right over here. So if you'll come over here and line up, we'll take some questions. What I would suggest is that you identify yourself by name and organization, and then we'll go ahead. Got a question? Okay. While we're waiting, Bill, let me ask you this. For years, those of us in the commercial press, if you will, have worried about the ability to ask the tough questions, to get the tough information published. I think so many of the people in this room have done that, even though the challenges are there as we see a consolidation in the ownership of the press. But public broadcasting always was seen as something of a citadel on the hill, immune from all of that. I think we're all concerned about your comments on the state of public broadcasting now. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future of public broadcasting and its capacity to have an independent and strong voice?
I said to a friend of mine on Wall Street a couple of years ago, how do you feel about, I asked him, how do you feel about the market? And he said, oh, I'm optimistic. I said, then why do you look so worried? And he said, because I'm not sure my optimism is justified. I am by nature hopeful. I always am. I can't imagine how to be in the world, this kind of world, without getting up every morning confident of a optimistic future and doing something that day to bring it about. But while I'm very optimistic about National Public Radio, where B.B. Krause works, who used to be a colleague at CBS, because NPR, first of all, has enormous public support out there. Their audience has grown to something like 26 million a week now, from about 15 million a few years ago. They've got a body of support. Not all of them are liberals by any means, but they have a body. They have a constituency. Second, they're a news operation, and it's easier to defend a news operation against the encroachments of power, if you have the guts to do it, than it is to defend individual producers. Public television, on the other hand, does not have a news gathering operation. We are a confederation of stations. And we're driven mostly by producers, by people who can raise the money and then negotiate with PBS and the stations to get their work on the air. And first of all, it's hard to raise money, even from foundations, to do tough journalism. They don't understand it. They're afraid of it. Corporations don't want to underwrite strong investigative journalism. I've had an exception. Mutual of America Insurance, life insurance, has been my sole corporate funder for 13 years, an incredible group of people who just wanted me to do the right thing by journalism. But that's very hard for young people to break into, and it's very hard for established producers to raise the money and then negotiate with a system that resembles more the Articles of Confederation stage of American history than it does the Philadelphia Constitutional stage. So public television is very fragile. Even though only about 15% of its funding comes from Congress, from taxpayers through Congress to CPB, that money goes, as does money from CPB to public radio stations, to local stations for infrastructure, for logistical support, paying the overhead. So therefore, while there is talk at public radio about separating from CPB and becoming an independent and autonomous independent operation like the BBC, it's impossible for public television to do that. We don't have the constituency. We have a public, but we have a lot of constituencies, people who love history, people who love travel, people who love conversations, people who love documentaries and that sort of thing. So in this new climate in which this administration and this right-wing conservative hegemony that has been in the making for 40 years is determined to silence every dissenting voice and to make sure no critical interrogation of the powers that be takes place, I am not optimistic about PBS and public television. I regret that. I wish it weren't so, and I hope I'm proven wrong. But as I said, even if George Bush says that White House falls apart, which I think it is doing, the political, religious, and corporate right that took the 1964 election when Goldwater was crushingly defeated, not as the end of a campaign but the beginning of a movement, they have a monopoly of power and are likely to exercise it for a long time to come. In no small part because of Fox, talk radio, 90% conservative. I mean, I am the poster boy on talk radio and at Fox because of the journalism we did on Now. And unless you're as old as I am, and unless you're as mean as I can be, And unless you're as indifferent to that sort of thing as I have become over the years, they can savage you in your early in your career, or they can destroy your credibility by the constant, vicious, unremitting attacks on you. So I am not, Rich, optimistic. Yes.
Hi, thank you so much for speaking to us today. And actually, that my question follows on what you were just saying. But I'm just wondering, if we in this room are all who are left, in essence, to tell the stories that have to be told, but so many of the journalists here work for consolidated media organizations that are increasingly driven by corporate commercial values. I just wonder if you have any advice on how to continue to try to be an effective presence in such settings, or are there additional or alternate avenues you'd encourage journalists to consider in an effort to reach people, perhaps through other channels?
I wish I could be more specific in responding. I mean, I run the Schumann Center for Media and Journalism, whose main purpose is to try to figure out and fund alternative independent journalism. There are so many mainstream journalists who, by choice or by coercion, are leaving the field because they can no longer do what they want to do, or if they do it, they get punished. I left CBS in 1986 because I was just weary of constantly negotiating for the ability to do basic good journalism, and I went out and set up my own independent production company. I was lucky to do it. I was out of age. I had a reputation. I was 50 years old or more then, 52, 53, and I was an anomaly. But it's very hard for you to go out and do that. I think that there are alternatives for writing and independently now, with the web growing up, offering a place for even mainstream employed journalists to get other kinds of work on the air. I so much admire what you're doing. I left out a lot of my speech because I was too long-winded today. I couldn't decide how to cut, but I did leave out the part where I talk about how hard it is to be a journalist today and how I'm concerned about your own welfare and your status in a media where news budgets are being cut, space is being cut, the time for expertise is being cut, experience is being discounted, and there is less and less time to explain the complex subjects like global warming. I think, and some of us around the country are trying to figure out how we can help you and other, particularly the younger generation that's coming up that doesn't want anything to do with newspapers, can find no home in broadcasting for creative, serious journalism, and are looking to the net as a way of finding their outlet and of trying to develop an audience. How to make a living doing that, very difficult to do. I go to the SCG website quite often because I like to get the latest accounting of the assaults on the right to know laws and your response to them. I think it's a wonderful website. But I see there that you're getting beat up as I'm getting beat up. And these laws, right to know laws, FOIA and the Toxic Recovery Act, all of it. It's a tough time to be a journalist. I said that in the speech I didn't deliver. My advice to you is to, I think collectively SCJ could sponsor some sessions around the country with the tenacious editors of these journals and the news and the managing editors and even perhaps the publishers to try to talk about, as I've talked to you today, about the importance of what you do in particular. I don't have much hope for general reporting, but I have some hope that even, what I say to these right-wing preachers when I meet with them are these right-wing corporate executives and these right-wing ideologues. I had Grover Norquist on he's the intellectual guru of the conservative movement. I had him on Now with Bill Moyers, and I said, Grover, I'm sorry I'm retiring because this is going to be a golden age for investigative reporting. And I agree with that. But I said to him in the green room, you got it. You're getting married next week. You're going to have a child. You've got as much a stake in preserving the environment as I do, a liberal, from the Johnson and Kennedy administration. They don't get it. They don't get it. So I don't have a specific answer to your justifiable question about what do you do if you care about these things, but you work for a newspaper, a chain, a corporate group that doesn't. I wish I did. Yes.
Hi, Christy George. I work for Oregon Public Broadcasting, radio and television, and I have some optimistic news. The story is about Tomlinson and Ferry broke last May during our spring pledge drive. And we were deluged with calls from listeners and viewers worried about the fact that our content would be censored and so on. And our management said, go on the air and pitch and tell people that we won't run it. And stations don't have to run it. I mean, we do have the right as a member station simply not running. Now, the question is where we get our content if that happens. But what we produce is local for the most part. And I wonder if in local public television and local public radio, for that matter, you see some optimism for the public broadcasting system.
I do in local public radio stations. And I do in a handful of public television stations that focus on the local. I mean, I spoke last night at a fundraising for Texas Observer, the little newspaper here in town that for 50 years has been speaking truth to the oligarchy in this state. And I reminded them of all the things. I reminded them that I've been trying to help them raise money among foundations in New York. And these foundations say, but that's local journalism. We want to reach a national audience. And I would say, well, like politics, all news is local. Every story just about, and I consider Washington, D.C. a very local and parochial town. Every story that the national media deal with comes from some locality, some particularity, some parochial place. So the Texas Observer, for example, has driven this story of the delay redistricting TRMP fundraising scandal down here. It's not the only issue in the indictment, but it's a very big issue. And I'm going to go back to these foundations in New York and say, look at this. If you don't fund local journalism, you're not going to have any national journalism except loudmouth pundits up there shouting at each other, because that's what broadcasting is doing. It's substituting cheap talk for serious journalism. So I think this goes to the answer to the woman who asked the question just before you. Wherever you are, dig into these stories, tell them in a way that makes them irresistible, and then drive the news chain, the food chain, upward. I think you could do that. As far as Tomlinson and that crowd is concerned, listen, I've learned one thing in my long life, and in my study, I'm a lay student of American history, and that is you never got any progress in democracy unless you fought for it, and the only way to deal with a bully is to stand up and challenge him. And if journalists start doing that, at least we may still get fired, but we'll leave a record, and who knows what response we might get. I think you talked about your radio station. I sometimes lose control when I make speeches, and when I do, in my documentaries and I don't in my commentaries on the air. They're crafted. I'm careful and all that. But sometimes when I get an audience like this, I feel free at last, free at last, God Almighty, free at last. But. I've made three or four speeches over the last few years that were militant, let's say. And there's a public radio station in Albany, New York. He does Alan Chartok. He's eccentric, but he's wonderful, like my editors used to be, Rich. And he has run that station in a way that has an umbilical cord to his constituencies, and they've got a large audience. So he runs my speeches, and he runs them in pledge. And every time he runs one of those speeches, it's incredible what happens. This is not about me. It's about the hunger out there for a lot of people to hear what we're talking about. So last September, I spoke at the Media Reform Conference in St. Louis. I think some of you were there. If you didn't read the speech or see it, you can look at it on the website. It got enormous circulation on the web. And Alan Chartok at Albany Public Radio Station took that speech and ran it over and over again in pledge and got over $700,000 in pledges. A record, he said, in pledging. Why? Because there are a lot of people out there, millions of Americans. I mean, look at the divide in 2000. I mean, Bush lost the popular vote. The Supreme Court put him into office. Who's serving all those people, not Democrats or liberals necessarily, but who just don't believe in the official view of reality? I'd say half this country or more. In fact, the surveys show 80% of the American people, more or less, call themselves environmentalists. That's a minority government in Washington pushing on the country minority policies fashioned by a corporate and political elite. It's time for voters to stand up. It's time for constituents to stand up. It's time for journalists to stand up. It's time for those of us. I mean, if we don't, we'll have nothing left to live for anyway, because this is a juggernaut coming down on you from corporate-dominated media, fewer and fewer companies owning more and more outlets, cutting more and more journalism, cutting space, going to celebrities. You're not going to survive in it anyway if you compromise a peas and try to have it. You can't. And the people who don't share the views of the juggernaut, I mean politically, religiously, and journalistically, have got a fight on their hands. But you know the Irishman who comes down the street? He sees a brawl and he says, is this a private fight or can anybody get in it? Well, you know, democracy is a public fight, and so is journalism. Journalism is about the public fight. Muckraking journalism always has been. The history of this country is different because of those muckrakers. Jacob Riis, a photographer in New York, took the police commissioner of New York by the hand and led him through the worst sections of New York in 1898 and 1899. And when that police commissioner became president of the United States, Teddy Roosevelt never forgot what he'd learned at the elbow of Jacob Riis. So we need some fighting spirit. And we may go down, but we'll go down in the right way. Yes, Gretchen.
I was intrigued by what you had to say about this large fraction of our countrymen who are evangelical Christians, and I've actually been thinking about that a bit myself lately. Many of us in this business are struggling with our own spirituality. Others are atheists or agnostics. We don't speak a lot. We don't speak the word God in these rooms very often. And so I've been thinking a lot about that, and I'm not really sure that I understood what you're telling us to do. It sounded as if maybe you're telling us that we need to abandon some of the mores and some of the standards of investigative reporting. And if we don't do that, are we to speak in parables? Exactly what are you telling us to do?
No, I'm not saying that by any means. I put a little parenthetical clause in saying without compromising our journalistic craft. And of course, I came back to talk about investigative reporting, which can't be made up. It can't be punditry. It has to be the toughest, most solid, most difficult kind of document gathering and crack. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that if you want to reach that 50 million conservative market, you have to try on some of what we do. And I was speaking primarily to the freelancers who are looking for ways, as is Glenn Shera, to try to waken those people to the environmental challenge, just as Mark and his colleagues were trying to do that on the most basic journalistic terms in the Times-Picayune. I'm saying only when you present the evidence that you have from the scientific community, if you think about how they're going to receive it, it might help the way you frame your story. And I'm not talking about all stories. I'm not talking about taking on an evangelistic mission of our own to try to convert that crowd to see the environment as we do. I'm only saying that there is a market for some storytelling, some journalism, some narrative that begins with how they see the world. And for example, I've been thinking about writing that piece on Noah and the flood. I did it when I wrote a chapter on the Genesis experience we had in the little book that was published recently. But I'm thinking about starting with how would I go to a congregation and explain to them what Noah and the ark might mean poetically and metaphorically in the light of the science of the times. The science is indisputable. I think we have to take our ground. I believe the main purpose of journalism is to get as close as possible to the verifiable truth. The verifiable truth. And I believe that even when we're trying to reach conservatives, it must not be with misstatements, exaggeration, misinformation, or disinformation. But it does need to be. You go back and read Henry Damaris Lloyd's Wealth and Commonwealth, one of the great muckraking books. He helped bring down the Standard Trust. Read Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. Read how he wrote about that trip he took across that bank of the Chicago River. I mean, he was worried. He wasn't trying to dumb down what he said, and he wasn't trying to compromise his language, but he wrote about it in language that an audience would appreciate as literature. And that's what I'm trying to say for some of what we do. Yes, sir.
Did Dan's going to have the last question, and I'm going to have Mr. Moyers respond, obviously. But please remain in your seats because we have a lot of tours. I need to tell you where to go so you can get on the buses and get back to the Omni if that's where you're going. Thanks.
Thank you.
Dan.
It's a big responsibility. Thank you for coming. I'm Dan Fagan, and I'm one of those newspaper refugees, and I'm now a teacher and a writer. We've heard a lot of talk about how bleak things are, and it's bleak. But you also talked about the promise of what's happening on the web, and there's a lot of that pugilistic instinct that seems to be on the web. That kind of work seems to be rewarded on the web. It's very pointed. It's very aggressive work. It's sort of like Jacob Riis. On the other hand, there's also a shallowness, a kind of laziness that you see on the web that is reflective of the worst kind of cable television opinion mongering. So I'm wondering, Bill, if you have any advice for how we can go about setting in standards for what will obviously be one of the dominant forms of communication for the next 20, 30, 40 years. How do we find an economic model that rewards not only aggressiveness, but also depth and evidence?
Right. Well, I wasn't talking about blogging. Blogging is personal punditry in a sense, and much of it does descend into personal attacks and outrageously unsubstantiated charges. I speak that as a victim of it. But there is a struggle going on to establish websites that are grounded in discernible and verifiable evidence. Joshua Micah Marshall runs a very good website called TalkingPoints.com. He's a journalist, started with the Washington Monthly, that trained so many aspiring young journalists and went on. He may have had a stint at New Republic, I don't know. But he's finding that he's making a slightly more than average living in terms of what newspaper writers make because he's reached the stage where he can run these square inch ads that book publishers and others want to take. And he's finding a way of becoming self-supporting at that. Now, that's unusual, but it's also promising. I had more in mind the kind of journalistic sites like Grist, the environmental website journal, which I respect very much. That's where I first became familiar with Glenn Scherer's work. And the Columbia Journalism Review's website, factcheck.org, not the daily, I forget it right now. I have a whole list on my wall that I go to. There are a lot of efforts that are going forward. The big advantage that I was trying to say is about the web is that if you do a really good story in the Austin American Statesman or Newsday, where you were, Dan, although Newsday is an example of what I was talking about the cutting back of reporting and your beat, it can now be driven out across the blogosphere, cyberspace, in ways that once upon a time it couldn't have happened and it would have died there. Much of what I read on the internet, most of what I read on the internet, is what you have written. It comes from a variety of websites. I go to some of your newspapers. And what I'm saying is if there is an audience there beyond the Seattle audience or the Long Island audience, and if we, and this is, I think, a real challenge for SEJ, if we could find a way to, as with news services used to, if we can syndicate in a way to the web what you do and find a way to provide an economic return for it, that's one hopeful piece of a very complex puzzle for which most pieces have not been fitted together. It takes a lot of more sustained thought than a one Johnny One Note like me, but it is something I think that the SEJ needs to take on as a major priority. Thank you very much.